Welcome, everyone. Welcome to our community members and welcome to students. On behalf of the Chester Ronning Center for the Study of Religion and Public Life, we welcome Dr. David Frimmer in our midst. I first got to know David 25 years ago when he was director of the Lutheran Office for Public Policy, located in Waterloo Lutheran Seminary, and I was a seminary student at that time. David at that time was responsible for editing Horizons for Justice, a document, a binder, which compiled all the Lutheran social statements and documents from North America. Back in the old days, you have to have a hard paper copy in a binder. You couldn't go to a PDF file someplace online. So this was serious work back in the day. David has had a passion for the engagement of the church in public life all his life. He has spoken on issues of human rights, Aboriginal rights, social and health policies, peace and justice. And we welcome him here to speak on the topic of dispatches from the front being prophetic in an age of belief. Of disbelief. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. I forgot what time it was we lived in. David is also addressing a group of students here from the Hebrew Prophets class. And those students are eager to hear from him, but they also have to leave after 50 minutes to attend other classes and other activities. But the rest of you are welcome to remain and engage in the conversation. As well, tonight at 7 p.m. at Messiah Lutheran Church, David will be speaking again on the topic... More dispatches.
Canada's national story, a tale of two or three or four stories.
Okay. So you're welcome to Messiah Lutheran Church again at 7 o'clock tonight. So welcome, David. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
So we'll see if the technology works. First of all, let me just say what a wonderful pleasure it is to be back on this campus. I was here many years ago. I can't even remember. For a meeting in the summer, it has really developed in some lovely ways. It's a great space, and I'm sure you're all very proud of it. How many of you are students? Okay, so you're very, very lucky. How many of you from the community? Great. Okay. Normally, I'd like to do some introductions around, but I think we'll kind of launch into it, and hopefully afterwards you can introduce yourselves. Come on in. The topic today is dispatches from the front, and one of the things that we often hear about today is what's the role of churches, and we often hear it in terms of negative terms. In some sense, this is the way religion is perceived today in the public arena. It's a problem. And in Canada, it's meant to be something you kind of push. We were just talking about this before. You want it out of the public sphere. And there are some history behind this. There's many politicians see it as so divisive. They don't want it involved in the public in the public discussions, and so you have the contradiction. Someone like Pierre-Elliott Trudeau, who was a deeply religious person, studied with the Jesuits, went on retreats himself, never mentioned his faith in terms of his public life as well. And so this is here you get the sense of how many people in the chattering class see religion today. And today, do we have a culture of disbelief? Stephen Carter of Yale University, who teaches at the law school there, wrote a book called The Culture of Disbelief. And in fact, if you're a person of faith, oftentimes you're characterized as someone who's kind of intellectually not competent to carry on an adult discussion about significant things, that you are kind of superstitious, you're not rational, that it's not a scholarly pursuit the way you look at things. And I would take some exception to all of these things. So what I'm going to do is not to be... we often focus on the negative things churches have done, residential schools. I often say to people, as was in the introduction, many people have a list of things that are wrong with the churches. A guarantee you that I have a much longer list than any of you could come up with, having been involved in sort of leadership roles over the years. My list of grievances is huge. But I also have a great joy in the church. There have been many things churches have done, and it's been a great privilege on my part to be part of that. So what I want to share with you are some of the more positive contributions to the common good, to the public purpose that I've seen over the years, and highlight some of those for you. So, let's start. I know this is a course on Hebrew prophets, so in deference to the course, what do we mean? What is prophecy? Somebody wants to, what do we mean by prophecy today? Those of you in the course ought to, this is your chance to shine here. Any takers? Is it about predicting the future?
I can give an answer.
Go ahead, yeah.
Someone who understands the times that they're living in, kind of, as well as the times that have come before.
Right.
Okay. Maybe where things are going.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good.
So you just want to eat that a bit louder?
All right, yeah, just say it again. Someone who understands the times, and someone who knows where sort of things are going, more broadly speaking. Yeah? Okay, what's yours?
An alternative reality to the dominant
kind of cultural trajectory. Yeah, okay. The Hebrew prophets, we meant something very specific, though. For the Hebrew prophets, there was God's trajectory, right? Of where society was supposed to end up or what it was supposed to look like. And the prophets come along and do what? They do the course correction. They understand the signs of the times. They understand what's going on. They understand how Israel has deviated from God's plan for society, the social project, and they want to get them back on track. And that's generally, is that fair? In terms of what we talk about the Hebrew prophets. Now, some people say that prophecy came to an end at a particular point in the times of the Hebrew scriptures. But let me ask you, are there Canadian prophets? That's not FITS, right? Some of the mining companies, there's lots of Canadian prophets in a lot of foreign places. But who do you think maybe some of the Canadian prophets are that might make it there?
Could Suzuki be one?
Sure. Yeah, he could be. Yeah. Now, again, we're not talking about ascribing religious motives to that. But, he's talking about a course correction, right? Who else? We're on the prairies almost, sort of, right? Tommy Douglas certainly would be, Woodsworth would be another one. These are prophetic people, right, who, in fact, talk about a course correction. So we often have an image of the prophets. If you Google this, what you end up with prophecy, you end up with all these people are talking about the end times and forecasting the end times. This is not what prophecy is all about. Prophecy is really about, for Christian people, for people of faith, complying with God's plan for society and maintaining the course. When people get off track, getting them back on track. And in fact, this has been part of the role Canadian churches have played. So there have been a number of ways that the churches have contributed to this kind of course correction. And I'm going to highlight some of those. I love political cartoons. So forgive me for indulging these, but we often think about church and state as sort of they have to be separate. How many of you have heard about the separation of church? This is something you're familiar with. What do you think that means? Anybody? What does the separation of church and state mean? Where does it come from? In the United States, they speak a lot of this. Any ideas? Does it mean there are two separate realities? Is that sort of? Well, actually, it means sort of that, but not quite. What it means is that the state should not impose itself on the religious sphere. In other words, when we talk about human rights, for example, I often say the first right is freedom of conscience and freedom of religion. Why? People need to have more ultimate loyalties than the state. And the state will always try to domesticate religious loyalties, right? They love that. You know, are you patriotic? In the States, you see this, God bless America, all the time. Well, remember Jeremiah Wright's sermon? Did any of you listen to it? If you Google, interesting sermon. because he got Obama got a lot of negative press about his association with his pastor, Jeremiah Wright. But very interesting about what Wright was arguing in that case was that the state should not domesticate religious obligation, religious convictions. And that's where we get some of this, even in the Canadian reality. So when we talk about a role for the church in public life, one of it safeguards freedom of conscience, more ultimate loyalties and convictions and values than those that the state would have for itself. Some of the things that churches have done that have worked on, and I'm standing in the way. Can you, I'm in the way, just maybe move a little bit.
You just roll your.
But one of the ones is in the patriation of the Constitution. Churches were very involved in all of that. There was even in fact, a group that convened was a rather contentious group to write a preamble to the Constitution, and looking at what it meant to what the role of God was vis-a-vis Canada and the state, and how we saw that. One of the other very important areas that people aren't aware of, especially in the residential schools question, has to do with Section 35 of the Constitution. It's in the Constitution, the Canadian Constitution, principally because of the churches. Why? The person that led that initiative was Archbishop of the Anglican Church, Ted Scott, who brought together Aboriginal groups. And so what you ended up with was the rights of Indigenous peoples in Canada being entrenched in the Constitution. The tragic part of that was that they never were fleshed out and articulated. There were supposed to be a number of constitutional conferences. Some of you may recall that. They were unsuccessful in detailing what that was. But remember, when this section was included, there was nobody coming to support First Nations to get these rights entrenched. And it was the churches that played that kind of role. The Meech Lake Accord, 1987, again, churches were involved in expressing strong reservations about that, which we will see later. Why? Because of the impact it might have on Canada's social programs and those kinds of things that seem to be at some risk. Lotteries, I love lotteries because, you know, the churches have been very strong against state-sponsored gambling. Now, I'm not a purist. I'm going to confess something to you, and it's on the tape here, that I used to win all my tobacco money for my pipe-smoking bad behavior from my father-in-law by playing poker. So I'm not opposed to sort of gambling in a rigid sense, but I am opposed to state-sponsored gambling, where the state, in fact, is the regulator, the beneficiary, the manager, and it is prepared to victimize at least 4 or 5% of the population who have problem gambling. And when we talk about another generation, that'll jump to 12 to 13, 14% potentially, is prepared to victimize some of its citizens so it doesn't have to deal with the facts that people don't want to pay their fair share of taxes for the kind of life we want. That was the issue regarding lotteries, casino gambling, that the churches took the lead on and were played an important role. Sunday shopping, that was in a number of provinces. Churches were opposed to Sunday shopping. Why? Not because people didn't go to church. People are going to go to church anyway, right? The reality was we needed a common pause day to interrupt the relentless cycle of the market, right? And look at it. The markets are 24/7, 365 now, and markets are, you know, driving everything, right, all the time. And in fact, so one of the arguments was to have a common pause day. Capital punishment, 1987. Everybody remember that debate? Capital punishment, when that debate began, the idea was to reinstate capital punishment. The polls showed like 80% of the population in favor of reinstatement of capital punishment. When it was finally voted on and not approved, the numbers had completely reversed. There was only like about 18 to 20% of the population that supported. Why? Because capital punishment doesn't get you a safer and more secure society. All the evidence pointed that. Churches launched a major campaign. In fact, we don't have capital punishment in Canada today in large measure because of that. Well, ecological justice, you can read the cartoon around global warming, climate change. Churches have played a very important role in this over the years. Acid rain. Anybody remember acid rain? God, am I the only Somebody, yeah, thank God. It's a long time ago, but Acid Rain.
Was that a band?
Yeah, could have been. Good title for a band, yeah. But churches were very involved on that issue in raising awareness, educational campaigns. How many of you were involved in 10 Days for World Development? Any of you involved in that camp, those programs? Right. Those were an education program that churches ran. Another area that was very important was around nuclear waste and mining issues in Canada, principally in those days. But what do you do with all the waste from these nuclear power plants? Nobody's got a solution. The best solution was that I heard at one time was put it in a rocket and fire it off towards the sun. It'll be disappeared. But these are, you know, economically not viable. But dealing with nuclear waste, mine tailings from uranium mining, all these kinds of things, churches were on the forefront of raising some of these questions. Global warming and the Kyoto Accord were another area that churches were early adopters in terms of trying to raise awareness about this. Look, the Kyoto Accord wasn't perfect. But the reality of the matter is we may have passed the tipping point already in terms of global warming, and at least it was a first step to do something at a time when not much was being done. Churches ran a whole lot of programs on that. The more recently areas of resource extraction and mining issues, internationally speaking, been very important questions, especially with church partners, and we do work in a multi-faith way. We do work ecumenically, which refers to work among the churches. And we also work with church partners who are actual churches in other countries. So when I'm using that term, I'm using it in a very specific way. But around mining issues, for example, in this part of the world, I know Lutherans have been involved with Colombia and some of the mining questions. Dietmar, I think you've actually been there quite a number of times. Some of these issues are very important. The oil sands, I won't say a lot about that. If you have questions, we can talk about that later. There we go. Relationships with First Nations is another one that I would mention. This has been a very important piece of work for churches. And yes, the residential schools issue, the sexual abuse of Aboriginal children, all the horrors that we've seen in the that have come out in the truth and reconciliation process and all that kind of thing are true. But on the other side, there have been issues that churches have worked. I mentioned Section 35 of the Constitution, the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline, Thomas Berger. Did anybody remember that? The Berger Commission? Yeah, good. This was a time when there was a pipeline was going to come down the Mackenzie Valley, and there was nothing to stop this process at all. There was no environmental review. There was nothing. And many of the Dene people at that time had not had any experience with inquiries or any of that kind of stuff. Project North was created by the churches. They worked with the Dene and the First Nations communities there and, in fact, stopped the Mackenzie pipeline until such time as the land claims and environmental issues were resolved. And I know more recently this pipeline debate has been reopened, but the First Nations there are in a much better position to engage that dialogue. One of the other ones that didn't get a lot of press, but churches have made an important contribution to, was around the Aboriginal women's rights and getting those reinstated. As you remember, as you may recall, when a First Nations woman married a non-Aboriginal person, they lost their status, had to move off the reserve. If an Aboriginal man married a non-Aboriginal woman, she gained status, in effect. This was a real big issue because a lot of the AFN, the chiefs and folks, did not necessarily like this, but churches pushed this issue. Notably, the lead was taken by the United Church of Canada, and this was going against the flow in a lot of ways, against what some of the Aboriginal leadership wanted. And there were some legitimate concerns there. I don't want to simplify it, but this was an area that was important. In 2000, the Jubilee Initiative. Any of you remember the Jubilee Initiative? Anybody participate in that? Yeah. The Jubilee Initiative advocated for a land claims tribunal. I mean, there's something like only 20 land claims disputes are taken on in any year, and yet there are hundreds and hundreds of these. It'll take us an eternity to resolve these, and yet this is one of the major outstanding issues. The churches put forward a process, a process that governments could adopt and put in place to deal with many, many more of these and expedite some of these, the resolution of some of these claims. As well, a more recent initiative has been around the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People. Canada has signed that, one of the last nations to sign on to that, but in large measure because of the church's work to push for that. Social policy has been another area that I would say churches have had a major role. 1966, the Canada Assistance Plan. Anybody remember what that was about? Canada Assistance Plan dealt with what issue? Which is still here today. Poverty in Canada. And put in place a cost-sharing arrangement with the provinces so that we could try and reach some more adequate levels of income for people below the poverty line particularly. Churches played a major role in seeing that put in place. It was gutted eventually by the federal government under, I think, the Liberals, Mr. Martin, who did away with that and brought in the social transfer or something, social transfer, which lumped health and all these things together. The universal health, how many of you are in the health Canada's health care plan? They're all supposed to raise, I mean, trying to give you something you all can raise your hand about. Yeah, we have universal health care in Canada. Why? Why? Because churches in large measure, in 1967, convened a meeting of all health ministers at the Chateau Laurier Hotel in Ottawa, and churches facilitated that meeting to get all the provinces on side. The labor movement was instrumental in that as well. So these are things that the churches didn't do it alone, I want to hasten to add, but played an instrumental role in provoking and pushing that along. In Ontario, there was the Social Assistance Review Commission looking at welfare, disability for low-income people, these social benefit programs. Churches and faith groups, this is a multi-faith coalition, actually articulated some of the principles that should inform the kind of welfare system we have. And in fact, there's been a lot of demonizing of people on welfare, and churches have put forward, and faith groups have put forward many ideas, not the least of which was something called a social audit. You ever watch The National on television, and you know when they get to the section, they have all these little indicators, you know, the TSX, the Canadian dollar and stuff. Why don't we see anything about poverty levels or homelessness or any of these kind of, we should have some of those kind. How are we doing on the social well-being indicators? Churches put forward and faith groups put forward the idea of a social audit to say, okay, you come into power as a provincial government, which is in your jurisdiction around these things. How do you get audited for how effective your policies are how effective they are in addressing things like homelessness, poverty, child poverty in Canada, which still is one out of five children lives in poverty in this country, to say nothing of what's going on in the fifth world conditions on many First Nations communities, which never get reported out and which most Canadians know nothing about. So we need to put forward views like this. The last one, anybody remember the Romano Commission? Right? Roy Romano, Jean Chrétien set up a commission on the future of healthcare. The interesting little story about this is we presented our brief, the Canadian Council of Churches, the Ecumenical Healthcare Network presented a brief. We made a recommendation that the federal government put in place a healthcare covenant, which would articulate the first principles of what our healthcare system should be governed by. And should be the benchmark against which any reforms or changes be measured, one of which we won't be surprised is that it should be not-for-profit delivery. Mr. Romano's commission, which went across the country, and churches organized in every province, is I think three or four sessions to help make presentations to the Romano Commission and educational events. We organize those all across the country. And out of that process, out of the Romano process, there was no independent study that showed that for-profit delivery of health care was more efficient or more effective. In fact, if you looked at some of the examples in the states, for example, when they privatized many of the not-for-profit hospitals, the mortality rates within those private for-profit hospitals were higher, so you're more likely to die than they were in the not-for-profit sector when they were run in those same hospitals. And that evidence is very clear in the studies. So one of the principles, for example, in the health covenant was that not-for-profit delivery should be preferred over for-profit delivery. There was a whole list of these kinds of things. You can see, I think if you go to the Canadian Council of Churches website, there it's there. Very interestingly enough, the premiers hated this, right? So they all met actually in Alberta, I think, at that time, and they all agreed to the health care agreement. right, which was basically about money. It had nothing to do with principles, nothing about fixing the system or anything. It was who's going to pay what. And that's where we ended up. And this has been the. And now the Mr. Harper has said he's not renewing it. So now the provincial ministers are all upset, hearkening back to this original health agreement, which was really a cost share, funding agreement. It wasn't even cost sharing, funding agreement. The first recommendation in Romano Commission was the adoption of a health covenant. And that's why the premiers didn't want it. And that's why they met in Alberta to make sure it wouldn't happen. And the churches, this is still a very good idea. And many people are still coming back to this saying, you know what, how do we decide what we do with health care? Why we do what we do? What's the point? What's the principle? What's the outcome and the objective? You can talk about it as the well-being of people and citizens, and we do. But what does that look like? And the health covenant kind of tried to lay that out in some very concrete ways. Peace and human security. Well, we're into the war on terror. one of my friends, Jamie Swift, has written a book with another, I can't remember the name, called The Warrior Nation. And we have become, if you look at how we've militarized international relations, right? I mean, it's all about the use of force. Now, don't misunderstand me. I do believe states do need to resort to the use of force in some circumstances. Truly, they do, unfortunately. I'm not a utopian or a pacifist in this sense. But I think we've resorted to it way too quickly. Everything is militarized now, you know, even the police now. The idea of community policing and all these things are sort of getting kind of marginalized in some ways. We've militarized these kind of international relations in some I think, unhelpful ways. But what if churches contributed to this? Well, one, anybody remember Namibia? Namibia?
Mm-hmm.
Where's Namibia?
South
near South Africa. Namibia and South Africa, 75-9. Who would have believed that Nelson Mandela would have been released from jail and today it would be moving, that we have a democratic state in South Africa? That was just a pipe dream there. But churches, way back when, started that whole process of opposing apartheid. And I can say for my own tradition, the Lutheran tradition, but other churches shared this view. It was one of the few times where, in fact, they identified a government, the South African government, as not a legitimate government. Why? Because it claimed that it had a divinely sanctioned right to impose apartheid on people of color and black people. And this was something that was we were very, very involved in. And when Mandela did come to Canada, he did thank many of the organizations that supported. But the churches were early involved in this. During the dirty wars in Latin America, Guatemala, Nicaragua, El Salvador, in the cone of Africa, Chile, Argentina, those conflicts, churches were one of the few groups to document the ongoing human rights abuses that took place there. And in fact, I remember in Ottawa when we met with some of the government people, where did the government of Canada rely for its information on? State-to-state relationships. Where did that information come from in terms of Central America? It came from the CIA, the Canadian government. And so our elected people, the members of parliament, one of the few alternative sources of information, and the documentation of the massacres and the ongoing violations of torture, and ongoing violations of human rights through torture and disappearance and all these kinds of things were documented in a very professional way by church networks and church organizations. Notably, the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America did a huge amount of work on this as well. The Bosnian conflict in 1991, churches were very involved in this. The war on terror was another one. The second Gulf War, I'll just mention this, this is the war in Iraq, right? And one of the reasons that Canada was not in the war in Iraq was because of the churches. There were 4,000 emails and signatures a week going into the Prime Minister, PMO's office, to oppose Canada's involvement in the war in Iraq. One of our bishops in the LCIC was at the funeral of Cardinal Carter in Toronto, and they apparently getting out of the, they had a lot of dignitaries, so they all got backed up and they were all stuck in this little room. And he ended up next to Prime Minister Chrétien, who, and they were talking about the war. He says, well, he says, I haven't got the business community with me, but he says, I got the churches, you know. And that was the reason why Canada didn't go into the war in Iraq. Notably, if you wonder whatever happens when you sign those little things and you send them off into the ether and they don't seem to come back, that's one of the reasons we weren't there. Now, the unfortunate part is we got involved in Afghanistan, but, you know, it's not a perfect world. But this was one of the things that was very important. Moving right along here, God the Economist. Let me say a few things about this. And we're getting close to the end. In the 1988 Canada-U.S. free trade debate, churches opposed free trade. Why? Because it wasn't about trade. It's all about investment. By the way, when you look at this new deal that Mr. Harper's negotiated with Europe, don't think trade. Think investment. Because it's not about trade. Most of the stuff that goes back and forth, beef and pork producers may benefit. I will concede that. We haven't seen the details. But it's all about access, freedom, the free flow of investment monies back and forth across the border. And in the free trade agreement with later on is a provision, I think it's Section 11 or Chapter 11, that allows for companies to sue governments for the loss of profits had they invested. And that's what the European one's probably going to be about, too. And by the way, when you hear all this stuff about Snowden and WikiLeaks, too, don't think about security, because they're all going to spy on each other anyway. This is what nations do. The issue is, can Europe get a leg up on the Americans now in the negotiations around the U.S.-European free trade agreement? I'm sure there's going to be some dynamics there. So we need some lateral thinking on these questions as well as, not to say that it's not a crucial question when you monitor the Chancellor and Merkel's phone and things like this. These are things that don't build trust among countries, but that's all very true. But just remember, it's not ever about one thing. Neither was free trade. The NAFTA agreement came into effect. One of the things that governments then said about churches said, "Well, look, you complained that the poor were going to be left out of these free trade. You know, we're going to be left out because of the U.S.-Canada free trade deal. Here we are, we're including Mexico." Well, what happened in Mexico, we were saying, is that this isn't going to be any improved quality of life. What is going to end up happening is, and did happen, was the dumping of all sorts of corn on the Mexican market, depressed the prices, and 2 months before the free trade, the NAFTA came into effect, the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America published, said that there'll be a lot of social unrest and dissension and potential violence once this agreement comes into effect in the southern parts of Mexico. You remember what happened on January 1, 1995? Anybody heard of the Zapatistas? That's when they launched their and the Interchurch Committee on Human Rights in Latin America had warned the Canadian government about that. The Ecumenical Jubilee Initiative, anybody in the debt cancellation campaign? Ring a bell with anybody? Over there. Yeah, we got one over there. Well, this is a very important thing because 650,000 signatures, 1 in 50 Canadians signed this petition. There was debt cancellation for some of the 50 of the poorest nations in the world. Debt that they didn't really have a moral obligation to repay in many respects, that was incurred under very questionable circumstances by leaders who often were not elected. And churches put that. Canada was, there were 17 million worldwide. For our size, Canada was disproportionately overrepresented in the number of signatures we had. I mentioned the social audit. Fair trade coffee. How many of you drink fair trade? I'm hooked on Starbucks, mea culpa. But they have fair trade coffee, right? Where did that start? Churches started that in church basements across this country, getting fair trade coffee, and then it went mainstream. Right? And so now you can get it on Parliament Hill. You can get it even at Starbucks. You can get it at many places. That was important. I was just walking down the street coming before I came down and went into 10,000 villages. The whole alternative trade thing, you know, direct trade, fair trade. You familiar with 10,000 villages? Helping people in these alternative economic arrangements, community economic development. Many of these things, you could probably think of examples in your own community. Well, make some connections. I'm going to quit with this. This is my, but These are some of the groups that that you may be aware of or not aware of. These are groups you might want to look on their websites and figure out, see what some of the... These are organizations that churches have created and have done a lot of work. Plowshares has done a lot of work around peace and security issues. Kairos is now the successor body to many of these coalitions that have had over the years. Does a lot of work on human rights and extraction issues and aboriginal issues and things like that. Of course, you know the World Council of Churches, Lutheran World Federation, some of these groups as well. But I hope this gives you a bit of a glimpse of some of the kinds of contributions the church has made to the public purpose. And I'm going to quit with that so we can... I think Jerome is going to respond a little bit and offer some comments. They probably want you here, too. So you better kind of come up, and I'll switch spots with you. Okay?
Thank you. Well, let's thank you first.
Okay. Yeah.
I don't want to take up too much time because I didn't know I was going to speak today. I was totally ambushed. Oh, we have read 12 books and papers and all this if I'd known. So it's good I didn't know. I have marketing to do. But I do want the students specifically to have a chance to respond. So I'm going to ask two questions, and I'm going to ask these questions really in the spirit of dialogue. To look at the ideas under the message that you're trying to put forward here. I have nothing to say really for or against this wonderful list you've compiled. It'd be great to have all kinds of links to and references to what we could further explore. But I'm going to say about two things you've talked about. I'll start with the first one because we can see it here. You're talking about making connections, which is great. Except that it's not obvious for non-believers and for non-Christians to make these kinds of connections. There's something that unites Christians that allows for non-denominational, ecumenical activity. And the reason why I think this is such a problem today is that the policies of most Western states for the past 30, 40 years have chipped away at the welfare state, chipped away at all kinds of public services and public assistance programs. And so anybody who believes in the necessity of working together has an interest in coming together to try to make up for that lack. So if we can't convince the state, then let's do things ourselves. That being said, it seems that faith is the thing that drives most people to volunteer, to get involved in charity work, to, not necessarily patch the safety net, but create new safety nets for whole areas that have been left aside. But it's very, very difficult for non-believers, for other believers to join in with Christians. And so I'm curious about what churches can do to make that kind of cooperation possible beyond these organizations that you have here, since the people on the tape can't see me pointing at the screen here. My second question has to do with the idea of the separation of church and state.
Could we answer the first question first?
They might be tied together. I think it might be helpful to have them, and then hopefully David can answer more briefly and then let others speak as well. You presented the separation of church and state as protection for freedom of religion and freedom of conscience, which is very helpful because that's not how we see it. It's in the States especially, the idea was that America is a one nation under God. There's this common reference to Christianity, and the state should not take ownership of it. But we tend to see it today as the separation of the church from the state, so that the church should not impede on politics. The church should stay out of politics. So when my students in political philosophy and politics talk about this separation, they mean, why do we keep religion out of politics? Why must we keep religion out of politics? And my understanding is also that this is how most people understand this this idea. So what can the churches do to repair that understanding, to repair that notion of freedom of conscience?
Well, thank you. Why don't you stay here in case?
Okay, I'm going to be quick on the first question. When I am a Christian, that's what impels me and motivates me in terms of this kind of work. But having said that, all of these issues that I've mentioned, you don't have to be a person of faith to support the positions of the church. In fact, on the South African thing, for example, the issue, many non-Christians, non-religious people were very involved. The question is we arrive at our conclusion, and then we can link around it. By the way, not all the churches agreed to the reasons why they should be opposed to apartheid. Some opposed it for one set of reasons, and others for another set of reasons. So we don't need unanimity of faith conviction to act together. And in fact, elsewhere, maybe one of the other things I'm doing when I'm here in the next few days is going to talk a little bit about the notion of the public commons, that everybody contributes to the public purpose and the public good. So I would clearly argue that we need people of all faiths, no faiths, any faiths, working together for the same kind of common purpose. On your second question, churches involved in politics. I think this is very interesting. I'm delighted to hear your students are asking why they shouldn't be. If you believe passionately, if these are your convictions, you should be involved in the political process. One of the studies I did a number of years ago was I asked politicians, should the churches be involved in politics, loosely speaking? Now, when I say that, I'm not talking about endorsing candidates. I'm not talking about any of that kind of stuff, okay? But one of the Reform Party members of Parliament at the time had a great answer. He said, if the churches are going to enjoy freedom of religion, they need to invest themselves in making the political system work. And that means being involved in politics. Now, so when I'm out speaking to groups, especially church groups, I don't ask people to raise their hands. But how many, and I'm not asking you either, how many of you make a contribution to a party? Do you make a donation to a political party? Do you go to their meetings? Asking of clergy, do you show up when the member of parliament has a community meeting or an information session? We need to do all of those things. We have a responsibility to make the system work. And we have something to contribute to that. When we asked politicians that in that same study, many of them lamented the fact that the clergy never showed up. Right, they didn't show up for things. The church people didn't show up and didn't speak up. One member of parliament said, you know, when we were dealing with refugees and immigration issues, I got all the people that didn't want to let any more people into this country. They were all up talking and making their points. But where were the church people who had sponsored the refugees, who'd worked with the refugees, who helped them get into this country, and who knew what was going on in their own countries? Where were they to speak? So we have to do those things as well. A couple of years ago, Michael Ignatius spoke to the Council of Churches, and I was there. There was this full-day session. And through various circumstances, I was asked to sort of say something at the beginning. So I went through a real laser talk. I mean, in 3 minutes, went through this kind of whole list very quickly. And the number of church leaders, bishops, presidents, moderators, all that came up and said, well, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. So we need to reclaim this history and need to know it. We need to do it not in a self-righteous way either. You know, this is not to reestablish Christendom or a dominant position for the church, but it's to say we do have something to contribute and we want to contribute it. And I think, so we need to do a lot more to help people understand the
success. Can you reflect a little bit about why that's happened? Why this amnesia? Why in the church? Why in the society? What's happened?
Boy, that's a good question. I suspect we don't know our own history on a lot of things. Mm-hmm. This is just one more of them, you know. And the memory we have is fading. I think some of you in university and studying these things, it's an important thing to remember and to look at. I know you're probably doing some of this in your political philosophy classes and things. But I do think we do have a bit of an amnesia, a bit of a blind spot on this. And to be honest with you, the church has been disestablished in our culture. Mm-hmm. We are no longer in positions of domination. It used to be that, you know, everybody was sort of nominally Christian and, you know, ministers would show up for political ministers and prime ministers and people like that, that you'd get a bit of a favorable discussion and debate. You know, look at the newspapers. How many religion editors are there in the country anymore? I think one, maybe in Vancouver. None. Nobody's writing, nobody's talking, nobody's discussing this. The other thing, though, that's happened in the political world, and I would say this, is that we've gone to a kind of political process that's kind of a la carte.
let me pick an example that none of you will relate to. When Mike Harris, I'm an equal opportunity critic, you know, so I have criticized all political leaders of all political stripes. So if I picked on one of yours, my apologies for that. But Mike Harris in Ontario, right? I never met one person in Ontario in all the times I spoke that actually voted or admitted they voted for Mike Harris. Right, and I would argue that his success in Ontario wasn't we'll leave it at that, since this is recorded. But the reality is nobody. But what did happen is people didn't debate. They don't discuss anymore. They don't come out for all candidates' meetings. And look at the candidates, especially conservatives. They don't show up. They have no obligation to figure they got to show up at an all candidates' meeting. In fact, some of them have been instructed not to. And so they, you know, there's no place to debate and discuss issues, right? I mean, where do we have conversations about these things anymore? How can we talk about our history? We can't. So this is a bigger problem. I think that's something we need to think
about.
This
is a footnote to it. I sometimes wonder if the kind of virulent public discourse, which appears to involve religion periodically, mm-hmm. single issues usually, where we have some person who has a virulent religious position and some person who has a virulent secular position, mm-hmm. that has been so dominant for 20, 30 years, mm-hmm. that I wonder if that doesn't cultivate amnesia.
Yeah, I would say there's some truth to that. By the way, you know what the secularization thesis is, right? As we become more educated, right, religion is really in the realm of superstition and myth, and it becomes less of a dominant feature of a society. So, you know, as Canada becomes a more secular society, religion becomes less important. That's the argument. Well, in point of fact, and less public, becomes private, right? And one of the things that I, of course, as you can tell my biases, we need religion to have a public face. Why? Because as we privatize it, we marginalize it, and it becomes unimportant in the society. And that means your convictions and your values become unimportant in the society. So, but the secularization thesis has been demonstrated to be wrong. Everybody thought the United States was an anomaly, right? That they had a very developed, educated country and still had a very dominant religious orientation, that this was what they called American exceptionalism. Well, the point of fact is it may be Europe, Northern Europe, and Canada are the exceptions, because religion is much more public everywhere else in the world and playing a different role. One of the things I think that's a big problem for people of faith and religious communities is that we get caricatured. And we do, you know, it's the odd ducks that get out there that do wacky things that seem to be representative of it. And that's not the Christian community I'm part of. That's not the Christian kind of convictions I believe in. By the way, the same thing happens in Islam with terrorism, right? Many Muslims say, this isn't the Islam of my faith. This is different. So we need to, I think all of this contributes to it.
Moment. What would it take to change that?
Well, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think this is the fundamental. I think, and that's not a bad place to be in. You know, it's easy for religious people to get a little arrogant, a little overconfident, a little self-righteous about things. But I'm pretty happy being in a bit of a wilderness right now. Because I think people need to say, okay, so what does faith mean in the public domain? What is a responsible and appropriate role for us? What do we bring to it? I mean, this is just a kind of quick tour. But I do think I think we need to think much more in terms of what's the nature of the public, and what's the role of the public in determining our social future. And I think faith convictions and values are much more on the minds of people than they've ever been, really. In fact, institutional churches are declining, but faith conviction is not. The gods are alive and well, according to Reginald Bibby from Lethbridge, a very noted sociologist of religion, says that religion is alive and well in Canada. It's just not gotten a place to have an institutional expression yet. And we do need to have these communities of deliberation. What really troubles me about the privatization or so-called privatization of religion, if it becomes only your individual concern, who holds you accountable for the weird and wacky, wonderful things you're going to come up with? Or me? We need communities of moral deliberation. And I think eventually we're going to start to see some of those coalesce. I think of the black, the civil rights movement in the United States is one, and it's the only example that comes to mind in a bit of a rush here. But the barber shops in the black community became these communities of political reflection and deliberation about civil rights for many Afro-Americans in the States. We need to think about where are these communities of deliberation going to be. And we've got to take back our congregations, churches, mosques, temples, parishes, all these places need to get back with something like this and start talking about the things that matter in terms of people's quality of life and help human life to flourish in this country. And I think that's a kind of a task that needs to happen. And if we are disestablished and no longer have privileged positions, maybe that'll help us get there quicker. Yeah, sure. I was actually there twice this year, and one of them was a discussion. You were talking about the Charter of Values. I mean, I just it's mystifying. One of the things that's very important in Quebec, though, to understand is, and it is important that secularism or secularist views bring, is the neutrality of the state. Remember we talked about the separation of church and state. In Quebec, you had a long history of the Roman Catholic Church playing a very dominant role, and for good and bad, you know, because when they went to take the schools out of the public, Catholic instruction out of the schools, for example, there was a backlash, even among people who didn't go, and they only, you're talking about 9 to 10% of the population participates in the church's life. I mean, this is not overwhelming numbers, right? But there was an overwhelming response. Why? Because the church that had safeguarded Francophone culture and language for many years when it was under threat there. But so maintaining state neutrality is important. And I would say it's important right across the country. But it's misguided, in my view, if you think the state can impose a kind of restriction on people's conscience. This is what I think would worry me. What's the problem with having people wear religious symbols if they work a judge or a police officer? I understand position of authority there, but I think this is just pretty much an overreaction and not very helpful. And maybe for other reasons too. Remember, I always say there's other issues, right? I don't know what the other issues are. I was there long enough to know there probably are some, and we need to figure out what those are, which may have more political orientations than dealing with secular values and that kind of thing.
I think Robinson is almost empty.
Yeah.
Place in Canada or a church or a movement in Canada?
Well, I think there are a lot of movements in Canada. Remember that many of the organizations, the social agencies and organizations in Canada that are providing and meeting human need were incubated and supported and sustained by churches. We need to get back to taking some initiative, some entrepreneurial initiative with creating the next generation of those organizations. So, I think they're out there, but we could talk more about that maybe afterwards. I know some of you have to go
in a moment.
Yeah, if you need to go for class, please don't.
Go and ask you to take cookies for your friends as you leave.
Good. Thank you for coming.
And the rest of you are welcome to stay. We'll continue our conversation today. Good to see you all.
Maybe just to pick up on this, because I did kind of abbreviate, I think there are many organizations that have been created. One of the ones, for example, I think of is Citizens for Public Justice. There are many, in all the political parties now, there's a faith caucus of some sort dealing with some of these things as well. So there are a lot of examples of that. A lot of community organizing organizations are starting, many counseling agencies, service agencies, those kinds of things as well. So there are some of those as well. There have been efforts to fund some types of organization. Yeah, I think it's this is a big problem because I think the current government is misguided in this. Historically, a partnership between governments and churches around the delivery of social services that are available to all people, not just some people, this is the key thing here, has been a very effective way of delivering sort of aid services and other kinds of things. And cutting off, Mennonite Central Committee, the Catholic Organization for Development and Peace, all these very reputable organizations organizations that have done, have distinguished Canada abroad for years, now not receiving, being cut. The treatment of Kairos, do you all know about this Kairos? I mean, this was the utmost of, well, I won't say more on that. But one of the things that was very interesting to me was, oh, thank you. One of the things that was very interesting about the Kairos thing is that when Bev Oda scratched Kairos off the list, they weren't even referring to the right Kairos, right? So they were referring to an organization in the Middle East. There's lots of Kairoses, right? And so they were referring to the wrong organization. So somebody
had Googled it.
Yeah, right. But to make matters doubly worse, was the organization they were referring to was an organization that was comprised of the leaders of most of the Middle East Council of Churches. I mean, it wasn't the Middle East Council of Churches. It was many of the leaders in that configuration who had published a Kairos document. And so they were quoting that document. So not only did they offend everybody in Canada that was in the church network that supported Kairos, they happened to offend all the church leaders that were in the Middle East. These are, and if you know anything about the situation in the Middle East, Christians play an important role there. Why? Because they're a bridge between two parties. I mean, they're the party, they're the faith group that's disappearing the fastest from because of emigration out of Palestine. And but they play a pivotal role in peace building there. So you've just managed to succeed in offending the very people you would like to have help you, if that was your policy, which it is not in the current government. The current government supports Israel almost solely and doesn't see a role for themselves vis-a-vis the Palestinians, I don't think, at least not in practice. So you've just sort of taken yourself out. It was very, very short-sighted. And to realize how the churches could help you, that would be very important. But I'm not sure that the evangelical, so-called evangelical churches, are gaining the kind of support that we think they are. I think there's a bit of a question mark there.
I have a question.
Yes.
So I just was interested in your
thoughts. This is a very ticklish question. You have to, I think, understanding. Listen, we have, across Canada, we're a very open society in a lot of ways, but we're also there are many people in this country who are fearful of people coming from other places, changing whatever it means to be Canadian. I'm not, let me be clear on this, I'm not at all. I think it's probably the greatest gift we have as a country in terms of the world. But I suspect that's true in Quebec too. And so I think there's a combination of factors here. The one that I understand from the people I spoke to in May when I was there at a conference that was on this, wasn't on the charter per se, but it was on the secularism and crossing what they call the cultural divide. My understanding is this whole role of state neutrality is really important. La Cité is, I think, the term they use in Quebec. And I think, you know, for the Jewish community, for example, some of the Jewish representatives who were at the conference, they, you know, I mean, if Christianity is the dominant culture and can employ the levers of the state, they could often, you know, a kind of a religious imprint has been put on some of these non-Christian communities in the past. So this is a very important issue. Having said that, though, remember that in France, there have been similar initiatives as well, and a lot of these have more to do with the people who are coming, particularly from the Muslim world, and restrictions on those kind of practices and things that are seen as a threat to quote-unquote the culture. And I think that we need to, if that's behind what's going on in Quebec, then I think that's very, very problematic. And the other thing is, my wife, I've said this to David the other night, my wife always says, you know, you go to a party, there's three things you're not supposed to talk about. You know what they are?
Sex, religion, and politics.
Sex, religion, and politics. And, yeah, and my response to her has always been, you know why that is? Because everybody thinks they know something about them. Right? Now, knowing something about two out of the three, I realize what people don't know about those. And I think there's a certain sense in which, you know, there's a lot of people who think they know about religion today, but they don't know anything about it. they don't, you know, for example, people who are not people of faith think that, well, you know, the best thing is to have a no-name generic kind of religion, right? You know, President's Choice, David Nickel passed away recently, you know, that kind of version of religion in public life. So you say only the minimal things, you know. And my experience, and by the way, I've spent 25 years working in the multi-faith world, the ecumenical world. I was on a committee of the Ontario government for 11 years, I think, that dealt with chaplaincy, the provision of chaplaincy, spiritual pastoral care, as we used to call it, spiritual care in public institutions. Non-Christian faith groups taught me one important thing. They don't want to deal with a generic, no-name version of whatever the faith is. They want you to be fully Christian or fully Muslim so they can relate to who you are. And they may not agree with your faith convictions. But I think people who are not part of that world, they have no clue about what faith involves, how much work is done collaboratively. I mean, even you were mentioning the church. One of the things when the churches in Canada have one of the largest political, social, human rights, organizations in the country, educational organizations in the country, that's contributing to public policy formation. Many people in churches don't even know that, right? So when you start talking about how Muslims, Christians, and Jews relate to you, people say, well, they all, you know, we shouldn't have any of it because they can't get along. Wrong. You know, in Ontario, we were providing pastoral or spiritual care, is the term now that's used, to many people in provincial institutions and doing it very well and working very effectively. Yes, there were disagreements and there were problems, but we were respecting the religious rights of people in the care of government. And it's not impossible. But if people don't have any knowledge of how religious communities work or how the multi-faith world functions, they don't know any of that. And they're not prepared to read anything about it either. I mean, you look at the Globe and Mail. By the way, a lot of these people who write this stuff, I like, too. I like them for other people. Doug Saunders, for example, in the Globe and Mail, you know, sees religion as a problem, right? I think he's wrong on that score. He's right on a whole lot of other issues, right? I mean, I think he writes very well. Margaret Winty, others have written on these things, this kind of very negative view about the role that religion can play, but they don't understand how religious communities work on the ground and the level of cooperation and partnerships that take place. Now, it's also incumbent on us who are people of faith to make those things work. So if you're in the Catholic community, you should be asking your bishops, so what are you doing with other faith groups? If you're have bishops or moderators and they do something, you should be phoning them and asking them what's going on, encouraging them. I'll tell you one thing. Whenever I said something that was kind of tickled somebody's fancy or didn't tickle, as the case may be, the bishop got a letter the next day complaining about me, right? But nobody ever told the bishop he did a great job when he stood up, you know, for the Jewish community or the Muslim community after 9/11. Nobody called. Well, call. You know, if you're going to do any kind of stuff, call and encourage. We need to strengthen those initiatives and make sure they happen. So it's a two-way street. But anyway.
I sent a laudatory letter to your bishop just before we began.
Yeah? Oh, did you? Good. Okay, good. Yeah.
Facebook. And
yeah, but...
some of what you were... So I don't know.
Yeah, and I want to make it very clear where I'm coming from. I mean, I think we need to have a clear articulation that faith, and in particular Christian conviction, has a role in the public arena, a public square. And we need to, I think the Ronning Center, the work that David's doing, and by the way, which is known all across the country, these kind of pieces, this is where we need to build that. Where I'm a little reluctant is to take on the Quebec issue vis-a-vis, I don't think it's helpful. I think it's ill-informed. And I think there are political motivations behind this that go far beyond the issue of religious minorities. But we need to defend the rights of religious minorities and the rights of individuals to express their faith for these non-Christian faiths and for Christians, too. This is part of who we are. You can't take and this is one of, if you look at politicians, I always laugh when the premier of a province says, well, my faith is a private matter, I don't, you know. No, it isn't. You know, we need to know who you are. If you're a Catholic, you need to be Catholic. If you're a Jewish, you need to be Jewish, right? We can't disaggregate the religious element, the faith element, out of people's identity. And this is a major problem in Quebec. And I think it will be divisive if it goes through as is. I'm not sure that's where they're going to go. But we do need to be clear about coming up with alternatives about and assert that faith has a place in public life. And it has a contribution to make. And I think one of the other, just one other little footnote is, you know, if you look at how Christians are treated in the public arena, too, right? I mean, you can't do anything that sort of, I mean, you can have all sorts of kind of, you know, you got people with beads or, you know, crystals or whatever out there doing any kind of thing or sort of having sort of generic kind of things. But if you got up, somebody got up to pray out of their own tradition in a public space, it wouldn't be allowed, you know? So, we need to think about, and I'm not saying that it should be just because of the position. We need to figure out and help people understand how to do that respectfully in ways. But I think these are important things. So it's a much bigger area than just the charter in Quebec. It's in Canada. We need to find an appropriate role for faith in the public life.
What's the biggest change you try to make
today?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things I'd say is we're in a kind of political ice age. I'm not sure I'd want to talk to those people necessarily because, I'm not meaning this disparagingly. We get the politicians we elect. And the political ice age we live in, I'll say this probably every day, every presentation, is we've got conservatives that don't conserve anything. We've got liberals that have got no new ideas, and so we're not progressing anywhere. We've got a social democratic party that's, you know, in solidarity with everybody, but we're not too sure what that means. And we've got a Green Party who was the brightest, you know, they're kind of interesting, but there's only one of them, right? And that's not going anywhere fast right away. I mean, years down the road. So for me, if I'm looking at, and you alluded to this, I didn't go into the great, to me, the greatest source of innovation and renewal, we need to figure out what the purpose of the country is. What's our national purpose? What's Canada for? And where that's going to come from is, in my view, from two areas. It's going to come from the voluntary sector, which is going to be the place, the engine of our economic well-being as well. And it's going to come from faith and faith communities. And I'm not just meaning churches now. But I think there's some imagination potentially there in those two sectors. We will not see it coming from the business community or the economic actors, maybe the labor movement a little bit, maybe some progressive voices within the business community. But I don't see it coming from the political arena. And so what we need to do is help our politicians get a program. And so we need to strengthen those things. So we need to renew our church's convictions about being public in their orientation. We need a public theology. I'm going to talk about that somewhere else, right, David?
Yeah.
We need to help animate the voluntary sector. And most importantly, and especially in a place like this, we need to help equip people through our educational institutions to be social or community entrepreneurs in community building ventures. That's where the new ideas are going to come from. That's where we're going to rebuild the kind of national purpose, in my view. Well, that's another day. But I think there's some things. We need to reanimate our communities. We need to take a hard look at our churches, our temples, our mosques, and all these places. We need to look at the role of religious movements and how we support them. I'm talking now just the faith sector, not the voluntary sector. But I think there's a lot of interest. I teach an undergraduate course. Most of these young people are interested in investing in our lives themselves in something that matters. And we've started a new program at where I am at Water Lutheran Seminary undergraduate program on Christian studies and global citizenship. And to me, that's really kind of they don't want to just find a job anymore. They want to find their life's work. And that's where we got to put the energy. But I'll be honest with you, we have a limited legacy. Now, everybody that's younger, a few of you are still here, but the folks that are older in the room, this is our legacy. This is our job. Job one is to figure out ways to help support the creation and the ways that can happen and what it's going to take to get us there, by opportunities or positions or creation of organizations, all those things. That's, I think, the task that we have ahead of us. And we have a limited opportunity to do that. I would say in the next 10 to 15 years, that's when it's going to happen.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
David, lovely to hear you and this evening at 7 o'clock at Messiah. So thank you.
Thank you.